All right, as I said yesterday, there's no audio for last week. Audio for yesterday will go online. In the week that I was out of town, I managed to forget that my laptop is not cooperating at the moment. I am able to convert it at home, but this means I got to move the bits on and move them back, which is no big deal. It just means probably at the end of the day before audio gets online. I'm actually in the process of moving yesterday's audio right now as we speak. So today's, I hope, will be on. I'll try and get it on right after class, but I can't make promises until I get home. Wayne, I think you asked me what was the plan for the rest of the semester. So if I remember the syllabus correctly, we basically have this week and next week left, and then we've got final exam. So what I'm planning to do with that is I'm going to take the next calendar week, obviously we had yesterday, to do the microkernels topic. And then I guess Tuesday and Wednesday of next week I'll use for review. If you have topics that you particularly want to review, email them to me. Let's see if we can hit them. If I don't get any topics from anybody, I'm going to assume you don't need any review. And there's lots of interesting stuff that we can cover, so send me topics. I will be responsive to you. That's both good news and bad news. Are there other outstanding administrative items? There will be a final exam. I only received confirmation of the room from the registrar about 2 minutes ago, and I did not think to bring it up, but I will email it to the class list, and I'll bring it in tomorrow morning. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I was thinking, what's the mean?
What's the what?
The mean, the average.
I had those yesterday. I don't have them with me today. I'll gladly bring them up tomorrow, if that's okay. Pragmatically, the answer is, with one or two outliers, the grades were actually so tightly clustered that for practical purposes, it doesn't matter what the mean was. The spread of grades.
One of the outliers opposed one of the cluster.
So. I don't want to ask you what your number was in public, and so why don't we do that conversation offline. Let me just think, how can I... The other thing I can say without violating anybody's confidence is the outlier of the midterm, I think there was only one, was not the same person as the outlier on Project 1. The outlier on Project 1, I have to get in touch with those people because I think I know what happened. There's nothing for anybody to worry about. I know that's a little vague. It's not sort of personally helpful, but at least it's something. And stop by and come see me. Let's by all means look. It's also possible there's a grading error. One thing I haven't had a chance to do because I was out of town is I hadn't reviewed these. So in particular, I'm planning to look at the outlier and see if maybe there's a misunderstanding in the grading process. And I do review sort of grades, but it was more important to get them back than it was to have them reviewed so late in the semester. Other questions on administrative matters? We've talked about a story of an operating system that looks kind of like this. That there's hardware at the bottom of the picture, which we try not to modify too much. Right, there's drivers, which are the low-level stuff that talks to the hardware that sort of sit functionally on top of the hardware. Probably the right way to think about them is these are kind of the proxies for the hardware that the operating system speaks to. That there are things like networking and file systems in a conventional OS that sit on top of these, but at this point the hierarchy picture is going to start to break down because in addition to file systems that sit on top of disk drives, right, there's a lot of things that do what you might think of as reflection across the network. So nowadays, right, you've seen network file systems, okay, but you've also seen something called an NVD or a network block device. So I can have a disk on one machine that I export over the network that is used on another machine. And as far as the using machine is concerned, it's just a disk with a somewhat awkward interface, right? And I'll hold a file system on top of that. So when the network gets into the picture, trying to figure out where the network fits into the hierarchy, if you want to draw an accurate picture, very quickly becomes an exercise of tremendous frustration. I will also point out that, let's see, so how should we try to do this here? I think the right way to draw this picture is probably to say that, at least in current systems, people don't simulate Ethernets out of distros. So, probably the way to think about this is that the network stack sits on top of the Ethernet, okay? And there's, above the network stack, there is what I might call a logical device layer, okay? And so all of the devices that might come up from the hardware, with the notable exception of the Ethernet itself, they either can come up directly from the hardware layer or they can be simulated above the network layer. Okay, so above this logical device layer, where you also have a notion of devices, you'll see file systems. However, just to make life really fun, so the network stack itself at the higher level comes through as a logical device. From the standpoint of other kernel function, or at least if... let me not do that. That's not what's going on. And then above the file systems, right, you have, aside from all of this, you have memory management. Although, memory management is tricky because we have MMAP, right? So memory management actually sits above the file system layer in a way. And above all of this, you have a system call layer. Okay? And somewhere up here, you got user applications. User not meaning you and me, but user as distinct from kernel. And you can see, I'm rewriting this diagram as I go, and it's still not right. Okay? And so one of the interesting problems in designing a large system is you really want to be able to have a story about what are the interrelationships between the components. If you don't understand what the interrelationships are, how do you design the system right? And there is no clear diagram of those interrelationships in a modern kernel. Right? There is none for Linux. There's none for Solaris. There's a rare one for Windows. I don't think there is one. And this has actually been pragmatically revealed in real work that's been done. One of the things that happened when the network clock device subsystem was introduced let me show you a different kind of reflection because it'll make the point I'm about to make much more clear. There are various kinds of what I would characterize as loopback drivers. So in the classic implementation of NFS, the kernel has a stub driver that looks to the system call layer, and system call layer looking down sees the internal file system interface, the VFS layer. But what happens behind the scenes is that these VFS requests get serialized into essentially byte streams, okay? And these byte streams get reflected back up to some file system client, okay? And that file system client may go across a network to talk to a file system server on some other machine. Right? This is called NFS or CODA or RFS or half a dozen other file systems. Well, that seems useful. The next move is somebody introduces a loopback block device. This, I'm about to tell you about a bug that arose in the network block device stuff, right? So they introduced what we might call a loop disk driver. Same idea, right? As far as the OS above is concerned, this looks like a disk device. Except under the covers, it turns the requests into, you know, byte serializations. These things go up to some user application, okay? And the user application which is a disk client, right? So this is the MPV client implementation. Okay, this client goes across a network to an MPV server, right? And this MPV server runs on some other OS, and it exports a real estate disk, or for that matter, it might export an MPV device to this guy. Now, one view of this is to look at this and say, this all looks kind of reasonable. You'd like to be able to cross-connect systems in this sort of way. It's certainly convenient. Well, watch out. One of the things that your local system is doing is it is paging, right? It's running out of memory and it's saying, I need to get rid of some memory, and so I need to put that memory on vacuum store. And what it does, what it needs to put memory on vacuum store, is take this memory right into that disk drive. Question
time. Is there a page file on it that there's Windows?
Is there what?
A page file. Like if in Windows there's page file.sys and all your paging stuff is that file.
Yeah, and I heard that is in which system are you asking?
In whatever system you're describing.
Okay, so the answer is it doesn't matter for what you're about to describe. Modern Unix systems will page the files. Historically they didn't. And it's the reasons maybe not to, but there are also conveniences to doing so. That's worth talking about the issue of my ultimately, maybe we'll go through the process of code, maybe we won't. But ultimately, this page is trying to get a disk somewhere. Okay. However, if we believe in traction boundaries, a disk is a disk is a disk, and that means the operating system wants to be able to treat the loopback disk device driver as if it was any other disk. Watch carefully and follow the bouncing ball. The loopback disk driver says, oh, I better serialize this request. I'll make up a byte string, and I will hand it back up to the MPV client. Because that's who really knows how to answer this query. I'm sorry, but can you close that window? Because the machine noise outside of the office. It will get progressively worse. The MPV client says, oh, good, I will take the serialized request and I will send it over the network. But the first thing the MPV client says, well, before I can do that, I need to get the request into my memory. Notice that the reason we started this exercise, we were short of memory. The MPV client may not have any more memory. The MPV client may, in fact, have been paged out. Let's not go there quite yet. So the MPV client says, I need more memory. Kernel says, good, I'll page something out so I can give you some memory. The kernel re-invokes the MPV driver in the kernel loopback driver. The loopback driver tries to invoke the MPV client. The MPV client does not respond because it's still trying to deal with the last request. Wonderful, you now have a deadlock. Because you have a cyclic dependency in design. Here's one that's really fun. Suppose the thing that we take to page out is the code of the MPV client. And that one's nifty, because that one we can page out without writing anything. The first time we'll know we're in trouble is when MPV page faults trying to access its code, which is gone, brother. So, these structuring diagrams are actually important. And there are lots of ways to go wrong with them. And by the way, as far as I know, putting swap on a network block device in Linux is still a really good way to panic a system. What's the resolution? Well, number one, my MPV client better run in pinned memory. I can try things that it is exempt from page out. I have to when I do this. Number two, I better engineer that program so that it runs in constant storage. You can mail it all at once, but it better free. The heap better, you know, once it gets initialized, the heap must not grow. Because if it were to grow, after initialization time, we could get into this looping situation. If I knew those things were true, I still wouldn't be done. Because the MPV system has to be able to turn around and invoke the network stack. That's what the network stack might do. The network stack might allocate kernel memory. and that could fail. Furthermore, I said we don't actually do loopback Ethernet drivers. That's not quite true. Right? We don't really create the illusion of a local network driver, of a loopback network driver that's proxying for a local network, but there are cases where we do Ethernet over Ethernet. Why? Because I have a backup machine and I want it to look like it's on some other physical wire. So I take the Ethernet packets, I encapsulate them in IP, I drop them on the real Ethernet, they go over to the target machine, which de-encapsulates them, gets the Ethernet packet, and drops it on the real wire. Here again, constant storage, things getting paged out, right? This is bad juju. Part of what's going on here is there are too many dependencies in the system to keep track of, and there's an insufficient degree of precision about what are the real requirements of it. So what's actually happening here is things like the NVD client, these are in the role of device drivers. But they're being run in an execution environment which is not the device driver environment, right? They're being run as POSIX applications. And the design model that a developer has for POSIX applications, and for that matter, the API that a developer has for POSIX applications, is not the design model that developers use for drivers. Right? Drivers are done in the kernel environment. There are lots of, you don't have fork in a driver, for example. You don't have NMAP in a driver. You have allocates and pages. It's just a different programming model. It's not that I can't express an analogous programming model in this user-level driver. I could. It's that the POSIX layer does not give me the primitives to actually capture what I need to capture. No notion of ping storage. I can write programs in POSIX that operate in bounded memory. What I can't get is the storage guarantee. Also, be careful, I can write those programs, I can't write them in any safe programming language. Because safe programming languages do not tend to give me contracts about storage guarantees, storage boundaries. There's no safe programming language where I can say, as part of the specification language, there are lots of implementations where I can say this, but I can't rely on any particular implementation saying it the same way. I can't say, the heap should be exactly this big and no bigger. Do not grow the heap. Pre-allocate it, pin it down, leave it the hell alone. There's no system where I can say that. I can't say that in Java, I can't say it in C sharp, I can't say it in Lisp, you know, pick your favorite safe one. I can express that kind of in C because C effectively has no runtime system. So I can get control of this essentially by taking over responsibility for the runtime system and doing my own low-level management. This is simultaneously the strength and the curse of C. But there's another problem. So why is it that this system arrived in this situation where these interdependencies are not terribly clear? And the answer at some level is it's 13 million lines and you can't read that much code. Now, this 13 million lines, you've got to be a little careful. Okay? It's tempting, and many Linux advocates do, in response to the argument about microkernels that I'm leading up to. They say, well, yeah, it's 13 million lines. Actually, it's bigger than that. But a lot of those lines are for devices that don't appear on the system you care about. I'm not very interested in the alpha device drivers if I'm asking a 3v6 question. Okay. That's a lot less true than it used to be because almost all machines now use the PCI bus, and that means those devices can appear on almost all machines. You can go out, you can buy a laptop based on a power PC part. Right? You'll find that it has an EPCI connector and a card bus connector. That means all those devices work for it. So this argument is not as true as it looks, but it's a little bit true. Certainly there's some other door devices that are different. That's not really where we get into trouble. But just to continue on the argument is, look, if you strip Linux down to its operational core, take all the drivers out, you'll discover a system that has about 250,000 lines of code. That's the core of the Linux kernel plus the networking system, which these days is pretty core. And if you kick out the networking system, you'll discover that the essential core of the Unix system is about 65,000 lines. What's this about a microkernel? It's not so big. Well, it is pretty big. We know how to build kernels that are functional, that provide the foundation for comparable function in significantly less than that. But the microkernel argument, while it's often presented as an argument about code size, it's not really the fundamental of the microkernel argument. Microkernel argument is an argument about system structure. It says, look, the way to structure a system is not to take 13 million lines of crap and shove it into one address space and hope that you get it all right. The evidence is that you won't. People are taking tools like RacerX, which is going to fly to Linux kernel, right? You turn these tools on, you got to understand, these tools are using heuristics. They're not catching all the bugs. But for the narrow class of bugs that they look at, and using all the heuristics, you turn these things on, you point them at the kernel, you find over 1,000 bugs in the locking subsystem alone. 1,000 locking errors. Why does this stuff run? Because mostly you don't get caught. And on my desktop machine, where I'm not really doing anything terribly aggressive, I can probably live with that. On my pacemaker, it's another matter entirely. On your pacemaker, I'm not sure I care that much. Actually, it is. So the argument is, look, we have a structuring problem, right? We have a large systems engineering problem, and we need to design a core that's not just small, because small isn't really the objective. We do want it small because we want to limit how much function we have to look at. And the problem with this story that you can take out the drivers is, you know, the MBD example tells you it's a lot. Hiding in this story that these lines of code don't matter was the implication that there was some sort of a hierarchical dependency relationship that I could rely on to know that I didn't really care if these things were misbehaving. There was some structure to the dependency relationships in the system. That's the argument hiding in here, and that argument is wrong for Unix. So what I'd like to have is a system where things are small enough to actually manage, deal with, test, ideally analyze, and where these kinds of dependency relationships are made very precise, very explicit, and are, in some sense, enforced by the architecture. Now, given an architecture, you can find a way around the rules of the architecture, especially if you're doing low-level system development. But the architecture tunes the way you think. Right? You don't set out by saying, this API is in the way, how do I get around it? You set out by saying, okay, here's the API, it at least captures the normative way of using a system. How do I go about solving my problem within the API? And then usually you can, sometimes you can't, and then you violate the API, and the thing is, in a system that's really well structured, you violate the API quite properly with a lot of fear and trembling, because whatever may be wrong with that API, it's been successful at maintaining a clear system structure for a large body of other stuff, and when you violate the API, you're violating the clarity of the system structure, and that has consequences. And with high likelihood, those consequences are not going to fall on you, they're going to fall on the person who makes some other change to the system that assumes the relies on contract that was embedded in those APIs that you just wrote. So the microkernel argument is a structure argument, not an argument about size. It was often presented as an argument about size. The argument went, smaller is better, smaller is testable, you know, smaller, more likely that you can actually get it all in your head. And for sure, you can't hold 13 million lines of code here. I've interacted with a lot of software people over the years of my career, and this will inevitably sound arrogant. I've met five total who can keep the size of system in their head that I can keep in my head. You know, who actually can do that. It's just, you know, we all have skills. This is one of those that I have. You guys have things I can't do. My limit on the size system that I can actually really keep in my head in terms of the system I can actively work on is somewhere around 100,000 lines. Those five people I'm thinking of, maybe they go to 120. That's the hard upper limit on what one person can manage in their head, and there are seven guys in the world I know who can do it. Now, probably there's, you know, 7 or 10 more I haven't met. Fine. The point is, code scales, humans done. So if you want to build a system that's engineerable, it's got to be done out of pieces that take advantage of hierarchy. I've got to have structure. I've got to be able to point to a piece and say, look, there's so many lines of code here, I need to get the entire design of this thing into my head. Right? And part of getting that into my head is knowing there's a boundary I can draw, and then at the boundary there are some contracts I get to rely on, and I'm just going to assume that those contracts hold while I work on this code. And that's what the NPD guys did, and the problem was they violated the contract. And there wasn't a way to solve the problem without violating the contract. Now, let me be a little careful. It's actually not lines of code that gets you, it's something about sort of what's the complexity space of the thing you're trying to get into your head. It's not, you know, the 10 extra lines or the 10 fewer lines. It's how complex the substance is. Those same seven people I'm thinking of, there are some very complex pieces of code where, you know, at about 10,000, that's all they can handle, because the code is just kind of deeply intertwined. So the microkernel argument goes, look, we might actually need all this function. Frankly, the microkernel advocates are skeptical about that. But if we want to do a system this way, the way we should go about it is we should start at the bottom with the microkernel. But what's the job of the microkernel? Number one, it encapsulates the hardware. Some, not entirely. Number two, it enforces boundaries between subsystems. And the idea in the microkernel story is we're going to take each of these components, and in order to assist programmers in keeping them cleanly separated, we're going to make each of them into a process. They're not going to be in the same address space. You don't get to reach over into the other guy's data structures and twiddle. We're actually going to put in boundaries, and these are not arbitrary boundaries, these are boundaries that if we were to draw the alleged system block diagram for Unix, you would discover all the boundaries we're talking about are pretty much there, or you can find a place and say, okay, yeah, I re-engineered the boundary here, but basically this was a nascent dividing line in the system block diagram. Maybe it hadn't been recognized, but in principle it was kind of in there. We're going to put subsystems and processes. So, in this story, our Ethernet driver is an application. It's a privileged application. It does have direct access to the hardware of the Ethernet system. That's why I said the hardware is only partly encapsulated. Our network subsystem is going to be a process. This brings me to the next thing that a microkernel has to do. Alright, so the good news about a process boundary is I get two boundaries. The bad news about a process boundary is for these things to communicate, I gotta cross these boundaries. And unfortunately, on modern hardware, that crossing is expensive. It was argued historically that it was expensive intrinsically. Ironically, so it was particularly, it was argued that way because Mach managed to implement this so badly, and Mach became the first popular microkernel. It turns out all the hardware on which Mach ran, it was possible to do it, I think, a factor of 100 better than Mach did it. On modern hardware, that may no longer be possible because the hardware is becoming progressively worse at this. Go complain to the people at Intel, they don't understand systems. Right. They're on the desktop here. They do understand systems, but their willingness to acknowledge systemic issues stops at the chip boundary. Maybe the chipset boundary, if I were really going to go out of my way to be fair. They're not interested in software people at all. So, right, processes, and that, by the way, includes address-based management. Some fast mechanism for communicating between processes. This is called inter-process communication. That is such a cumbersome word that you will almost always hear people talk about it as IPC. So what else? A notion of process, notion of address space. And we're going to build up in this way. Also, physical memory management. Now, what I mean by physical memory management is one of two things. Either the microkernel is going to be responsible at some level for multiplexing abstract resources onto available physical memory, or it's at least going to provide a primordial physical memory address space that will then be reallocated by some application. I do not want to make it sound like there's one school of design about how to build a microkernel. In fact, until fairly recently, there were about 15 different research microkernels. Each of them differed in some fairly interesting way about how to do these low-level management activities. Today, I believe there are two surviving research microkernels, ours and the L4 kernel, which is, I guess, driven out of Dresden and New South Wales now. There are several reasons why that shrinkage has occurred. And one is, some of the ideas that were proposed in other kernels didn't play out. The second is, there's only so long you can keep a research group going, things just attenuate. Okay. But the third is that these two systems that are sort of still alive and kicking have done an unusually good job on performance issues. I could make a case that the exokernel is still alive, but I don't know that it's actually being used in real world. So, these things, though, in some fashion, the microkernel has to do them. And inevitably, there are a few services that need to exist and probably need to be supported by the microkernel. The obvious one that comes to mind is the system timestamp counter. A lot of processors now have a cycle counter that's application visible. And you want a way to read it, and at least on some application, or time of day. There are a bunch of things that need to look at it. It's actually a service that you want to protect, because you don't want everybody to be able to ask what time it is for various reasons. So there's a few very low-level services like that that many microkernels choose to provide. Also, some foundational protection things. So things like, I have read-write access to a page of data, I'd like read-only access. Somebody has to actually manipulate that bit, and the protection bit itself has to be in privileged memory, because we don't want applications to be able to turn on write permission arbitrarily. So, protection, which is part of clean isolation, is one of those primordial services. What else? This was controversial. I believe that scheduling, or at least the lower half of scheduling, needs to be done in the microkernel. Let me explain what I'm talking about and what the dispute is. If I look only at a unit processor, there are two possible designs for scheduling. One is to say, I have a process, it's an application. Its job is to decide who will run next. When it does so, it advises the kernel what should the timeout be when this process will stop running. When the process stops running, the kernel turns around and sends a message back to the scheduler saying, the process I was running has stopped, who should run next? And it knows who the scheduler is because there's a well-known relationship between the kernel and this service provider. And the reason to take the scheduler out of the kernel is that first it isolates it so you can test it more easily. It makes it more replaceable, but also there are services like memory allocation that you'd like the scheduler to be able to use. Although that's a little problematic, because one of the things that you want to schedule is the storage allocator. And L4 actually, at least at one time, worked in the way that I described. I actually don't tend to buy into that view, and the reason I don't buy into that view has to do with multiprocessing. Here again, there are different schools about how to do multiprocessing. But basically, if I'm in a multiprocessing system, and I'm a process, and you're a process, and I'm sending a message to you, well, if we're both single-threaded, it's pretty clear where that message has to go. Right? It's got to go to whatever processor you're on, A, or you've got to come over to my processor. But one way or another, the bits have got to get to the right destination, and the set of choices is pretty limited. However, if the recipient is a multi-threaded process, then conceivably any of those threads might be an acceptable destination for the message that I'm trying to send. Like there's a necessary demultiplexing decision in choosing the thread which will receive. Because of the cost of going back up to application level, that is not a demultiplexing decision that should be made usually. The kernel actually needs to have a policy. And probably the policy is going to be something like, hey, if I get lucky, there is a receiver thread that's idle that's already on my CPU. That's good because I don't have to move any data across the bus and I'll get to share the cache and all that's wonderful. And failing that, now I'm thinking of a large scale machine, failing that, let me at least try to move the data to an idle thread that is at least on the same cluster on my machine, because at least if I'm in the cluster, I won't share the cache, but the cache coherency traffic that sits behind moving the data will not go out onto the main system bus, which is slow. Now, if I don't have one of those, I'm going to have to go to whoever I can get, and at that point, I'm going to go across a really slow bus. So you can see that there's a policy argument for how to choose a destination.
You need to buy a cluster.
Yeah, I was about to say, let me explain what I mean by a cluster. So, used to be you had one CPU. And then people said, oh, let's put a bunch of CPUs on a board. And nowadays, that would be a chip. The rule of thumb is, if you're doing it on a board now, wait 5 years, it'll all be in a single package and a single chip. So, in fact, you can go out and buy that processor today. You can't quite get it at CompUSA, but you can order it from Buick. The number of people in their houses who need a four-processor multi-threaded machine is very small. But what happens is the more processors you add, the more electrical complications you get, and this has the effect of forcing you into a hierarchy. Okay? So if you stay within a chip, you're sharing certain physical structure of the chip, and that gives you some advantage. If you stay within the cluster, what you'll discover is there's a fast interconnect between the chips that are, these four chips that used to be on a board that are now in a single carrier. These boards, right, are hooked into a system bus. Oh, I should also explain, clusters tend to have a local memory. These boards are in turn hooked into a system bus. Now, system buses also run into electrical limits. Now, it's not that you can't hook on more boards, it's that you trade the number of boards for the speed of the bus. Because the signal has to propagate. And it's worse to propagate because when the signal gets to the other end of the bus electrically, what it does is part of it keeps going off the board, part of it reflects back and creates noise in the bus. And so you end up with a hierarchy here. Okay? And so on up the line. So if you're looking at a 256 processor machine, you're looking at a machine that has a multi-layer bus architecture. So to answer your question, the term cluster is a little bit funny because it depends on whose machine we're looking at. But generally speaking, a cluster is some set of processors sharing both a cache coherency bus and a local memory bus. And one of the big issues in large-scale system design is, am I coherent only with my local memory, or does the hardware provide consistency with remote memory as well? And there's a big open issue about how that should be done, and it's been open for at least 20 years. It's certainly the case that if I have to go off of my cluster, right, I now have to invoke a fairly sophisticated and slow bus protocol. So there's an enormous penalty for any computation that leaves my cluster. So you end up with this hierarchy that defines both speed and semantics at certain points in the hierarchy. Right? When I switch coherency models, that's a semantically visible change. It changes how I have to speak to the things on the other end of that bus. More? All right, so I'm going to have to stop in a second, but what we want to do in the microkernel, I sort of finished the story about scheduling, but I didn't get all over there. So why do I say lower half? It turns out that this demultiplexing and destination problem is structurally very similar to demultiplexing the next thread to run. In fact, if the target thread is on your processor, you are, in fact, choosing the next thread to run. So the line that we've made, the division that we've made in the Kyoto's architecture and its ancestors, is that there are sort of two layers of scheduling. Right? One is the one where I decide what's going to run, and what are the rules for the scheduling. Given the rules, I compute an actual schedule which says what's going to run for the next epoch. But that's just a table-driven thing, particularly in a real-time scheduler. That'll tend to be table-driven. So the compromise here is, since I actually have to know at a very low level about activation decisions, putting the table-driven dispatch part of the scheduler in the kernel is not a big deal and it actually starts to make sense, but you need outside the kernel the policy of how you put things in that table and what things go where. So the planning part of the scheduling is still done outside of the kernel, but the execution part of the scheduling is done inside the kernel. The same kernel, I should be careful to say. Now, this address space part. So these are features that the microkernel has to have. There are also some constraints. Okay. The primary constraint is the microkernel itself has to run in bounded memory, right? It doesn't get to raise its hand and say, please run down and buy another chip. It doesn't get to paint. Paging is done outside the microkernel.
Is this included by kernel and privileged processes, or should it be?
No, I was very careful about what I said. There will be privileged processes that we also want to put this constraint on, but not all of them. And there's some that can't. The other requirement, and this one turns out to be staggeringly hard to do, you'd like it to be the case that every operation performed by the microkernel completes in bounded time, and not just in bounded time, but bounded time with low variance. Because variance of operations is a source of illicit communication. But setting that aside, right? The job of the microkernel is to do its job and get out of your way. Any function that can be moved down to the microkernel successfully should be. What's left tends to be pretty limited. Now, one view of that is, one way to think about this is, this provides the core functionality that you need in order to structure the rest of the system in a coherent way. Right? Its job is to provide structuring primitives, not features. Line is sometimes pleasant. The Unix attitude is the job of the kernel API is to provide you with a basic feature set. And there is a feature set generally provided by a microkernel. I mean, map is in some sense a feature, right? But the feature selection is not driven by convenience of application. It's driven by an argument about system structure. that an application might use that is a generic user-driven application, right? Something that you would recognize as an application. Features that an application might use are going to get provided by these application-level services, right? So there isn't really anymore a single place you can point to and say, that is the system API. There are only interfaces provided by various services that your application may be able to call. And that set can be extended over time because those interfaces, they're implemented by application-level processes. And I'll come back and dig into this a little more tomorrow. But why do I say the bounded time thing is hard? So we talked about some issues of deadlock and some issues of deadlock avoidance. But bounded time is something called a liveness problem, right? When I say bounded time, I mean when from the moment that my application enters the kernel to the moment it exits the kernel, there better be a strictly finite number of steps that it has to execute to finish. Now the problem is that in a multiprocessor, because we get into locking conflicts, one CPU can get in the way of a second CPU and can alter its timing properties. And unfortunately, there does not appear in principle to be a clean way out of that. You can detect it, and one party can back out, and that's what you have to do to break the deadlock. The problem is that that party backs out, make it hit again and again and again and again and again. So guaranteeing progress here is actually tricky. And we're actually wrestling with that issue at the moment in the Kairos kernel. There are a couple of possible solutions. None of them are very pretty at all. So we're talking about a very constrained kind of program. And I also want to say, when I talk about bounded memory, I don't mean just it has to live within the available physical memory. Bounded memory and bounded time together mean I don't get to use arbitrary recursion. I've got to be able to tell you the maximum size of my kernel stack. So you can recurse, it's not, you can't use recursion. But you have to be able to state that there's a maximum depth that the recursion could in principle take. And you have to be able to reason about that by knowing the data structure. So for example, if you want to do a recursive implementation of a balanced tree, which is the natural maintainable implementation, that's fine. And we know the height of a balanced tree, so we know the depth of the recursion. But in order to state a specific depth, we need to be able to state an upper bound on how many objects are going to go into this tree, because log of that, that's the height of the tree. We need to know what that bound is, because we can't grow the stack in kernel. Linux also has such a requirement. It doesn't manage it, obviously. Let's come back to this tomorrow.